Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. I'm Kurt Heelan, the managing editor of Pro Basketball Talk here at NBC Sports. And with us today to break down all the news around the NBA, our own Sean Hyken. Sean, who also works for Bleacher Report covering the Bulls, we'll talk a little Chicago, but works for us at PBT covering the league. And thanks for doing this, Sean.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so this is going to be fun. We are going to go over a lot of things, and I think the most interesting news right now kind of comes out of Philadelphia.
As always.
Yeah, exactly. Because they are such a fascinating story. As our own Dan noted the other day in a story, if they lose their next game, and it almost feels like when they lose their next game, they will have the slowest start to 30 wins. No team has started with their first 30 games with less than 2 wins, and they're well on their way. So with everything going wrong, obviously they're trying to change that perception. They bring in Colangelo, and Colangelo brings in Mike D'Antoni. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't really get it, honestly. Like, I get the kind of the principle behind it. Like, it's sort of the coach version of what the Colangelo hire seemed like it was. It was like, okay, we have a lot of backlash for this tanking, so we're going to bring in Jerry Colangelo, who's a guy that all the, you know, old school basketball people respect. I feel like Mike D'Antoni is kind of the same thing, where now Jerry Colangelo is here and he's going to say, okay, I'm going to bring in this coach who's a proven coach, a veteran coach, a guy that people around the league respect, just to kind of get some of the heat off of us. I don't see how this really fits from a basketball standpoint, because, you know, as far like, they don't, this roster is really so undefined right now, and the one guy that has that actually has like a lot of long-term potential is Jahlil Okafor, who is a post player, which is just not really the kind of player that has traditionally thrived under D'Antoni. So I get kind of why they did it, like from an optical standpoint, but I don't think it's the right fit.
Yeah, you and I are on the same page here. I get what they want. And by the way, Brett Brown had them that first year he was there before they had Okafor, before they had any of this, had them playing lightning fast. Like, he wants to play faster. He wants to do that. He slowed it down a little because of the personnel. But I think that this becomes my concern if you're going to bring in Mike D'Antoni, which is he has always been a guy wed to his system and wanting to play a certain way and trying to turn, you know, Pau Gasol into a stretch four for moments. Now, eventually in Los Angeles, he adapted. But it took a while. It wasn't a smooth transition at all. He came in wanting to do things his way, and it wasn't pretty. And you're right. That system only works if you've got an excellent point guard who distributes, you know, who can score.
Right.
But if you don't have Jeremy Lin coming off the pick and roll for 2 weeks in New York, or if you don't have Steve Nash running the show, talk about the weakest. I mean, I don't know that there's a worse guard rotation in the NBA than the Sixers. So, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do there.
Kendall Marshall put up some good numbers when he was with the Lakers a couple of years ago when D'Antoni was there.
He's no long-term answer. In a D'Antoni system, he could be a reasonable backup, where if you give him 15 to 20 a night off the bench because he's a good passer in open court space, you know, with the right shooters around him. But, I mean, this roster doesn't have shooting. And then you got to the big point, which not only is there Okafor, you're, in theory, your best guy going forward, the highest rated of all the guys you've drafted, is still Joel Embiid.
I don't think Joel Embiid is going to play. I have to see him actually get on the court in an NBA game before I believe that that's an actual thing.
Yeah, I guess there's that. But, assuming that you're thinking that he's going to do anything for you, that's another guy that, look, is athletic for a big man, but you've just got to, you know, you can't have him running up and down the floor like he's Anthony Davis at this point. So,
especially with like the foot problems.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't get at all, like you said, I get it in the sense of they needed to bring in somebody, but this is not the guy I would have brought in. And it creates the other question, obviously, right behind it, which is, yeah, they gave Brett Brown a 2-year extension, but does he feel this?
I have no idea, but you know what? I just feel so bad for Brett Brown and all of this, because no matter what, and I mean, there's nothing to suggest that he isn't a good coach. He has guys playing hard every night, even though they're losing a ton of games. But no matter what happens going forward in his career, every other job he interviews for, there's going to be this thing on his record that, you know, his record as a head coach, his win-loss record, is going to be like comically bad just because he was in this system for 3 years or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like they wouldn't have signed him to this extension if they weren't at least planning on keeping him around for a while. That maybe that changes. Maybe some, you know, maybe something radical changes with the roster. They start getting more talent in. Maybe Joel Embiid actually plays and is good, and they decide they want to accelerate the rebuild with a veteran coach. But I would be inclined to think that that Brett Brown is safe for now.
I would have to think so, because he's actually gotten the guys to play hard, and when given enough talent, actually got them to play defense. Like he's done as good a job as you could humanly ask of somebody with the pieces he was given. It wasn't Brown, and frankly, you know, it's never been on the players about tanking. This was a Sam Hinkie systemic, you know, we're just not gonna field an NBA team, really, and put it out there, and it shows, you know. I do get the need for wanting to bring in a veteran to help guide these guys, but that's not going to change the veterans that are out there that they're looking at, the Shane Battier and Elton Brand. You know, Battier'd be great in the locker room and as a leader and would have a voice, but he's not going to win them any games on the court. You know, there's
are
a
you
going to
be wait? My the thing I don't understand about the Battier has been retired for 2 years now. Are they bringing him in as a player or as a?
I thought it was as a player.
So if you're Shane Battier, why are you?
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of money. It would take a lot of cash.
I guess because you're, you know, because Colangelo is tight with Mike Krzyzewski and he's a Duke guy. That's the only, and he could do it as a favor to Coach K. That's the only reason I could think of.
I can think of 5 million reasons, and I don't know if I do it for any less than that. Like you have
right,
to come
that's
in.
That's the thing. If you're Shane Battier, he's made enough money in his career. He doesn't need the money. Why would you? You know, he's living a good life. He's retired.
He's still living in Miami. He's like
living
a good life. Yeah.
Playing golf every day. Why would you come out of retirement to go back on the NBA travel grind?
And you're brought in essentially to be Crash Davis to Nuke the Luke. Like you've got to come in and try to guide the young guy and get them to play the right way. You know, you're not there to actually play basketball. So it's just kind of I don't know why you would do that unless you wanted the money, and that's why maybe Okafor makes a little, makes a little more sense just because.
Oh, Emeka Okafor.
No, that's not Emeka. I'm thinking of Elton Brand, but wrong guy. Maybe
Okafor wouldn't be bad either. I don't know if he. Yeah. I don't know if his body is healthy enough to play. But that's
it.
A
yeah.
big man that.
They've got
had a pretty good career.
I can get why they want to do that with the veteran a little bit, but I don't know. And you and I have had this discussion before. How much does that make as big a difference in the locker room? I had, after the last podcast, and I'd written a story saying, I'm not sure it makes a big difference. I had a couple people around the league text me and like, yeah, it makes a difference. It makes a bigger difference than you think. So I guess it depends on who you're listening to, how big a difference having that veteran guy in the locker room actually would make. I'm not convinced that it keeps, you know, I'm not sure that it keeps Jahlil out of TMZ in this particular case, but...
It may not have kept the first thing from happening, but it may,
yeah.
You know, if once the first thing happens, if you've got a guy who can get in his ear and say, look, Jahlil, this is not how you're supposed to handle this stuff, it might prevent something like this from happening again, and then maybe it wouldn't have gotten to the point where there were three or four things in a row that all leaked out at one time, and it was just a really bad look for him and a bad look for the organization. That's how I would... That's what I would say would be the difference. Not, if they had a veteran on the team, he wouldn't have gotten in that first bar fight or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. 19-year-olds make stupid... I mean, you and I never did, but other 19-year-olds made bad decisions with their lives. And I don't think that trend's going to not continue with his... It's funny because this team is just going to continue to be bad. They're going to continue to be at the bottom of the rankings. And, you know, hey, they will have a prime seat for the Ben Simmons sweepstakes. Along with the Lakers, who are trying to keep their pick, and you know whoever else is in that mix, but that's what they've come to. You know, it's funny too. They'll end up they'll finally get their top pick. They'll get Simmons. They'll bring him in. They'll get Saric over. Things will look better, and Colangelo will get all the credit.
Right, and then you know Sam Hinkie might be out of a job, and
yeah,
Brett Brown too. Right, and Saric has said that he's. Planning on coming over.
I cannot believe he's going to do that. For those that don't know, the deal with Dario Saric is if he comes over next year, he has to play under the rookie scale the year he was drafted, I believe. But he has to play under the rookie scale. if he holds and stays in Europe one more year after, he falls under the situation that Thiago Splitter and some other guys have, where where now you're essentially you're not a free agent, but you are not under the rookie scale contract. You can negotiate whatever you can negotiate with these guys, so you can make 5-7 You know, you can get closer to the mid level exception if they think you're any good. For coming over, so you gain a lot of money if you hold out for that year. If you're willing to play one more year in Europe, he said he's not going to, but that's a lot of cash to say no to. So we'll see how that shakes out.
Right. Yeah, I didn't really understand how that worked either.
Yeah, it's basically he falls under that. If you're out of the league, if you're drafted and you don't come over for 3 years, you essentially get to, you don't play under rookie scale. You get to negotiate your own deal.
Well, right, that's what happened with Ricky Rubio.
Yeah, a few guys
drafted in, in 09, comes over in 11, he's still under the rookie scale. And then here in Chicago, Nikola Mirotic was drafted in 2011. He comes over in 2014. They basically signed him to a deal worth the equivalent of the mid-level exception. So he's making $5 million a year right off the jump.
Yeah, and that's why you know, that's why you do it for Šarić, because he was a low enough pick that, and he'd be under the rookie scale versus what's going to be the new norm under the new new TV deal money. So
the new mid-level exception might be like $10 million.
I don't know if it's going to be that high, but it's going to be like seven. It's going to be seven or eight right out of the gate at least. So I mean, if you can get that kind of money, if you know, seven or eight might sum up the first 3 years of his deal if he comes over now, or he could wait a year and get seven a year. Boy, it's hard to not wait that year out, even though there's risks to that. That's a lot of cash to walk away from. So we'll see what he does. Other news around the NBA, Kyrie Irving is back. And that's, I think, just good for everybody, because we all wanted to see him out there on Christmas, right?
Absolutely. No, we still don't know whether Harrison Barnes is going to play for the Warriors. And obviously that's not nearly as big of a deal as Kyrie Irving being back. But, you know, you wanted to see as close to a fully healthy matchup between these two teams on Christmas, especially now that, you know, we've kind of seen what these Christmas games are, and that's really the only one that's going to be any good anyway. So, you know, having a healthy Kyrie Irving, at the very least, having all three of the Cavs stars healthy, that's going to be good.
Yeah, and it sets up the one thing. Look, when they've gotten beaten this, and Washington beat them earlier this year, you can get to Cleveland going small, or you could. You did, obviously, during the finals. It's happened a couple times this year. But it changes the dynamic with Love when they can play Love and Tristan Thompson up front, LeBron at the three, Shumpert and Kyrie in the backcourt. Now, going small against them isn't going to be quite as easy. That, you know, they've got some defensive guy. You know, Thompson can protect the rim a little, get some boards. LeBron's LeBron. Kyrie is going to make plays and can defend. And Shumpert's out there. Suddenly, that they can play small well, too. And I think that that's the thing I'm... You know, if you're into the Christmas Day games, by the way, check out our Thursday podcast. Dan Feldman and I are actually just going to spend an entire podcast Thursday breaking down the Christmas Day games. And I think what's most fascinating about that game to me is that I want to see the small lineup versus small lineup with every, you know, again, Harrison Barnes isn't there, but essentially, let's roll it out there with the real small lineups and see what this does to Cleveland, if they can hang or not.
Did you see Kyrie yesterday against the Sixers?
You look, you know. He moved pretty well, but he was obviously rusty.
Good. I mean, I didn't see him. I was seeing Star Wars yesterday, so I didn't see
him. Oh, okay. Well, let's take a pause right there. I will say this. Kyrie moved well, missed his first five shots, seemed to find a groove, only played 17 minutes. It was fine for coming back. It's kind of what you'd expect. Let's get to the important stuff now. How was Star Wars?
I enjoyed it. You know,
no spoilers, but yeah.
I won't spoil anything. I found it very enjoyable. I'm not like a big enough Star Wars fan that I can like go in depth into, you know, how consistent it is with all the extended universe stuff. My brother is a lot more into that kind of stuff than I am, but I liked it. I liked it a lot more than any of the prequels. I found it enjoyable.
I've heard and read, and I'm not into the extended universe stuff that much either, but that J.J. Abrams and the writers essentially tried to go their own direction rather than follow one of the existing paths.
Right. Well, it was cool. Like, I mean, I thought it was an enjoyable movie, but it was also just like it was cool. Like, they did some stuff that was clearly like referential to the original movies. Like, you know, the theater I was in, it was in a pretty packed theater yesterday that I saw it, where, you know, the first time that Han Solo and Chewbacca come on screen, there are big cheers. The first time we see the Millennium Falcon, there are big cheers. Like, you can tell they clearly did that stuff to cater to fans of the original movie. But I thought it wasn't just like a pure nostalgia fest. It was actually a pretty enjoyable action movie, just kind of on its own terms.
That's good. That's what I want to hear. I'm probably not getting to go to until next week and after the holidays. So, or after Christmas and somewhere between Christmas and New Year's, I'm gonna make you work extra long one morning so that I can go see the movie. Basically,
that's fine.
So we'll work that out off air somewhere. I don't think
PBT scheduling conversation now a part of the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing's gonna draw in listeners like us breaking that down in detail. We'll move on to the one other great interesting story and something you're a lot closer to was Jimmy Butler.
Yeah.
Goes to the press, and you were probably there. I think that because that was at home, I think.
I was actually not, when he made these comments, they were actually in New York, so I was not there.
Okay. And Jimmy Butler comes out and says, essentially, we've got to be pushed harder by our coach. We're not getting pushed hard enough. And this kind of, to me, doesn't this just tie back into that they have yet to come close to finding an identity under Hoiberg?
Right, and I think that was somewhere to be expected. Like, I think, and I've been saying this for a while, I think that the Bulls front office, Gar Foreman and John Paxson, kind of have let their personal dislike of Tom Thibodeau, which was very real, and there was fault on both sides in that relationship, and it was time to move on and all that stuff. I think they let their personal feelings about Tom Thibodeau cloud the other issues with this team, and I think they thought that just getting rid of Tibbs and bringing in a new coach that was somebody like Fred Hoiberg, who was more laid back and who's somebody that they, you know, are more on the same page with, in terms of personality, was just going to fix everything. But really, what happened is they kept the roster the exact same. Like Bobby Portis, who just got his first real minutes against the Knicks the other night, he's the only difference on this team. Everybody else, they brought back Butler, they brought back Dunleavy, they brought back Aaron Brooks. The entire roster is literally exactly the same. And so you're expecting this team to just have a radically different identity overnight. No, that's not going to happen. So I think, you know, with these Butler comments, and I was actually at shoot-around this morning when he kind of talked and he walked some of it back a little bit, and Hoiberg said that they had a talk yesterday, and it seems like they've kind of cleared the air and they've moved past it, but it just kind of gets at an issue. Like, what he said when he said it was kind of irrelevant. Like, something like this was going to happen at some point, because I just don't think this core at this point is really sustainable.
I think that becomes part of the issue, doesn't it? I think you're getting at the key, which is, this team was originally built around the defense and a whole lot of, you know, Derrick Rose creating for everybody, and it is now transitioning to Jimmy Butler's team in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But the roster is aging. You know, Pau Gasol is getting them some offense, but he's not great on the defensive end, and he's not young. Noah at this point can give you some defense, but isn't going to give you a lot of offense, and it's old. And it just goes on and on down the line. And it's a kind of, you look at that roster and you're like, it's a little mismatched, but then you look at the East and you're like, all right, well, Cleveland's going to be Cleveland for a few years. They can't, like, they just can't compete with them. They're not even like on the same level. And by the time Cleveland fades, this roster will have to be overhauled, or at least, you know, modified. And then you look at some of the other teams that are on the rise in the East and you're like, yeah, I don't quite see where they seem on the wrong end of the curve, and that they've got some, you know, Foreman and Paxson now have some work to do.
They do, and I'm just not really sure what there is for them to realistically do. I mean, the only piece that they have on this team that is, you know, clearly a long-term guy, clearly a cornerstone of the team for years and years to come, is Jimmy Butler. But, you know, everybody else, you know, Noah's a free agent this summer. I would imagine they're probably not going to re-sign him. Taj Gibson has 1 year left on his deal, and he's, you know, I would imagine they'll probably trade him at some point next offseason. Pau Gasol can opt out, and I think at this point it's pretty clear he's not going to be back. Rose has one more year on his deal after this, and who knows what's going to go on with that. That could get kind of messy. But, you know, there's really, other than Butler is the one guy that you know is going to be around long term. And other than that, like, it's so wide open what they could do. They could go in so many different directions, but they also don't really have very much flexibility to do that because they don't really have anything to trade that other teams would want. First of all, this is not a front office that really makes trades in season. Like, if you go back and look at their history of making trades, the last time they traded for somebody in season who actually was a rotation player was John Salmons in like 2008 or 2009 or whatever year that was. They traded Luol Deng a couple of years ago to Cleveland, and that was purely a salary dump to get under the luxury tax. They got a couple of future picks. They didn't actually get any players back for that. So this is just not really a team that has a history of making moves in season. And then, you know, they're not going to really get a lot of value for Noah because he's not the player he was on offense and he's expiring. Pau Gasol has the opt-out and he's 35. Derrick Rose, nobody's going to want to trade for Rose because he's making $20 million and he's not worth that.
Yeah.
No, so it's like, I mean, Taj Gibson and Mirotić are like the only two guys that might have value. And I don't know really what – Mirotić has not been playing well at all this year, so I don't really know what you'll get for any of these guys.
And that's actually an interesting point. What happened to Mirotić, who actually seemed okay at the start of the season, or very early on, but is just cannot throw a pea in the ocean, to use an old Chick Hearn line right now. Like, he can't hit anything right now. What happened to him?
He's just always been a very streaky shooter. I don't know. I mean, when he came over from Europe, he was kind of touted as this knockdown shooter, this stretch forward, like a Ryan Anderson type of player. And he just has not been that. Like, he has this, it's there at times, but, like, he'll have a game where he'll shoot 6-for-8 from three, and then the next game he'll shoot, like, 1-for-5. And it's just, he just does not have that consistency. He never has. Sometimes it's been that pump fake thing that he always does. But I don't know. I don't know. There's really no clear answer to what's wrong with Mirotić. He's been shooting the ball confidently, but he's not a consistent enough shooter to really be a threat long term.
Interesting. So, yeah. Oh, what fun it is in Chicago. I'll ask you, since you've been watching a lot of the East, I asked A'Sherrod Blakely this in the last podcast, and since you follow a lot of these teams, what team do you see breaking out of that middle pack in the East? I mean, it's Cleveland and everybody else, so who could break out of that pack?
You know, I don't know when you say break out of the pack, I don't think that anybody's going to really seriously challenge to make the finals. But
if you're
asking me who might... you know, get in the conference finals unexpectedly, or who might, you know...
Who could get the two seed? Who could, like, find a way to find a groove, either whether through trade or whatever, but who's the team that could, like, you think, like, wow, they could very well end up the two seed and make the conference finals and maybe win a game, you know,
There's two that I think have a better chance than anybody else. One of them is Miami, just because I think the talent, like, they haven't really fully put it together yet, but I think the talent is there. And I don't know what's going on with this whole trade thing. I don't think Dwight Howard really makes them, as crazy as this is to say, I don't think Dwight Howard really makes them better if that's what they decide to do.
Yeah, they can't move, by the way, for people who are out there, you can't move Whiteside. Like, it's,
no.
People don't realize, Whiteside makes less than $1 million. Dwight Howard's making 20 this year.
Yeah.
Much else that has to go on and make that trade work that the numbers just don't shake out.
So I think just in terms of like the amount of talent they have, I think Miami is up there. And the other one that I like a lot is Charlotte.
You know, that's a surprising team, too, because you and I were on the same page here, I think, where we were like, I liked them, and then Michael Kidd-Gilchrist got hurt, and we're like, oh, so much for their playoff chances, and they've turned out to be rock solid and a little bit better with Jefferson on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, they're just a team. Well, first of all, I think a lot of people didn't really expect Nicholas Batum to be playing as well as he has for them, because he had a pretty disappointing year last year in Portland when he was playing through a wrist thing pretty much all season. But he's been great at both ends of the floor. And they're just, Steve Clifford is just such a good coach. And, you know, Jeremy Lin has really fit well into his role coming off the bench. They have so many pieces. Their defense is really solid. Again, I don't think any of these teams in the East are, I think the thing is, like, with any of these teams, if you want to say, like, who has the chance to be the two seed and, you know, maybe give Cleveland sort of a series, you have to look at which teams have the fewest reasons why they can't. I mean, Chicago, we've kind of talked about, they have their own set of issues. Washington has not been that good. Atlanta has been really inconsistent, and they have some guys that are injured right now. Charlotte, I look at, and there's no one clear thing I can point to say, yeah, this is why they're not going to be in that conversation.
Yeah. The other team I personally tend to throw in that conversation is Toronto. But
if they get Carroll and Valanciunas back, absolutely.
That's the thing. Carroll, yes, but it's Valanciunas is huge for them, and people don't realize outside, like, the 7-footer makes him look. He's not a great defender, but he's big. He stays in the paint. You know, he gets some plays by being big, and he really helps their offense. He's a skilled offensive player. They are dramatically better when he's on the floor, and they can go as far as he can take them. And if he comes back healthy and they get Carroll back, that's the one team I think, if they get right, could reach that far. But again, it's a coin toss. I'd probably pick Miami if you made me choose right now. So
yeah.
And they've got some, like you said, they're looking around at trades, but I don't think they make one. I think they kind of live with Whiteside through the rest of the year. Then he bolts and goes get paid somewhere more than he should because, you know, look, unless he's, they're not playing him in the fourth quarter, if anybody notices.
Right, and everybody's going to have so much cap space, and he has that, he's young and he's got that upside. Somebody's going to pay him max money.
Yeah, or a lot, and it'll go back. And the one other thing a couple other things we're going to talk about. Damian Lillard is about to Monday night miss his first NBA game ever. Which is kind of crazy when you think he's been around the league for a few years. He has never missed an NBA game until tonight due to injury.
Yeah, and he's a plantar fasciitis thing. It's probably smart of him to sit out. The Blazers are not a playoff team.
No.
They actually, it's in their best interest to not make the playoffs because they owe their pick lottery protected to Denver the next 2 years because of the Aaron Aflalo trade. So they need to not make the playoffs. They need to keep their pick. And the other thing is that Lillard, you know, he's the one guy. This is a roster that doesn't really have a lot of, you know, long-term pieces that are, you know that are going to be guys that are going to be there for a long time. Lillard is the one guy, you know, he's a multiple-time All-Star now. You know that he's going to be the centerpiece of the franchise for years to come. He just signed that 5-year extension. It's really, if his foot is bothering him and he has this plantar fasciitis, it accomplishes nothing to play him in a game in a season where the Blazers aren't going anywhere anyway. So, you know, it kind of sucks for him that this streak is not alive anymore, but, you know, it's probably in the best interest of everybody long term for him to just sit out until he gets right.
Yeah, and the thing about plantar fasciitis is that the only way it really gets, I mean, there's treatments you can do and there's things you can do, but there's nothing works like rest. You've got to rest.
Right. If you look at the playoffs a couple of years ago, Joakim Noah was playing through it. Joe Johnson was playing through it. These guys, like, you can do it, but it's better if you don't. And again, the Blazers, if anything, this is a good excuse for them to lose a bunch of games in a row now and get a better draft pick and keep their best player. And they're really the only one, you know, long-term sure thing that they have on their roster healthy for the long term.
Yeah. Yeah, he's sitting out Monday night at Atlanta. The next game, just in case you're curious, they are at the Pelicans on Wednesday. Let him go down to Bourbon Street and party, but don't play him. Then they host the Cavaliers on Saturday, second night of a back-to-back, so I'm sure you can get them. That's actually one of those sneaky games where if he comes in and plays well, and Cleveland is a little flat after, depending on what happens with the Golden State game, but that's
right.
People sleep on that second night of a back-to-back trip up to Portland from San Diego or from I'm sorry from I'm from San Diego from the San Francisco from the Bay Area, that's not a 5-minute flight. Like that, it's a little bit of a hop, and then you get in late and you're a little bit tired the next day, and maybe you can sneak one in depending on how the Cavs do. Then they're at the Kings and Denver and some teams they could risk. But I'm with you. Their offense falls off a cliff when he's gone, but at this point, since they're not going to the playoffs, what's the point?
Right.
And we move on to one other topic of interest. You brought this up, actually, which is great. The Hall of Fame nominees are out. And I think we can agree on, a few obvious locks, right?
There are three locks to me.
Okay, and they are?
Allen Iverson, Shaquille O'Neal, and Yao Ming.
Exactly. Yao Ming is going in through the international, but either way, you can put him in through the NBA if you want, however you want to do it. He is an absolute lock for, especially with everything he's done internationally. And honestly, right. I mean, if you ever got to, people who didn't only saw him at the end when his foot was bothering him and he could barely play, you will
people
never
forget how good he was.
Yeah, God, he was the most skilled. I mean, he was a big man. Look at this way. Look at his free throw percentage. He nailed his free throws. He was 7'6", could block shots, could play inside, was physical, and was deft from the outside. Like, would kill you from 17 feet. Just destroy you. Like, did everything very well, very polished, and talk about it.
Unfortunately, when you're that tall, I mean, your body is just not meant to.
No.
If you look at Bill Walton, had problems with his feet. Ralph Sampson had a whole bunch of health problems over the years. When guys are that tall, it's just not, sustainable to have a long-term career. It's unfortunate, but yeah, I mean, in terms of, Yao Ming was one of the best centers in the league, and it wasn't just he's taller than everybody else, so he can. So he can just overpower everybody. He was so skilled.
Yeah.
And then you have to factor in the other stuff too, like his impact and how responsible he is for the popularity of the sport in China and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It you know you There's no way he's not a Hall of Famer, whether you want to put it through the international committee or just, you know, regularly.
Yeah, exactly. He was an incredible player. And by the way, you know, you're probably in the same boat. If you're covering the NBA for a living and you're in locker rooms like we are and around, you know, at Summer League and around players a lot, you become desensitized to height, like, especially in that context. Like, you see a guy who's 6'6 to 6'8 in a bar and you're like, man, that's a tall guy. But, like, we become really desensitized to it. Like, hey, 6'8, you know, what is what is. There are very few people I've met over the course of my time in the NBA where I'm like, my God, that's a massive human being.
There's this image that just sticks with me for years and years, and it's from the opening ceremonies of the 2008 Olympics in Beijing. And so they're showing, like, the processions from all the different countries, and then the procession from China is walking in at the end because they're the host country, so they go last. And Yao Ming is walking next to this 5-year-old kid who literally goes up to his ankle.
Yeah, he is one of the few people who stood up in the locker room. We were there to do interviews, and this was after a lot of the surgeries. You know, I've always wondered how different his career would have been had China not made him play every summer for internationally. They ran him into the ground.
Well, it's kind of the same thing with, like, you know, in baseball, a lot of these Japanese pitchers that come over, and they have such a higher workload in Japan that their, you know, their careers, once they come over to the major leagues, are a little bit shorter.
Yeah, exactly. He was just, yeah. But he stood up, and he took his shoes off, and you could see the scars on his foot from the surgeries.
Yeah.
But then he stood up, and you're like, I mean, there's like Shaq is this way. There's only a few handful of guys where you're like, my.
Boy, Hibbert.
Yeah, like Hibbert. That. It's where you're just like, wow.
Honestly,
I don't know they came that big. Mozgov is a little bit that way.
He's not seven. Yeah, Mozgov. Who's that kid on the Spurs, that Boban?
You know, I've not seen him in person yet.
I saw him walk by the media room when the Spurs were here a couple weeks ago, and I was just like, oh my God, that is one of the biggest people I've ever seen. He's not another guy. He's not 7'3" or whatever. But LeBron in person is just massive.
Yeah, yeah. You don't really realize how thick LeBron is and how...
Blake Griffin is like that also. And then Dwight Howard just looks like a cartoon character.
He's the wide shoulders and, like, the skinniest legs. He is...
Yeah.
Blake Griffin's another guy who's just... And I'd met outside of basketball, like, years ago, actually at a volleyball tournament, but years ago I'd met Wilt Chamberlain, and he was sort of that same thing where... Like, Wilt and Shaq is the same way. It's like you took a normal person and you just blew them up to 7'2". Like, they're just...
Oh my God, Shaq. I met Shaq a couple of years ago when I was this is when I was still working at USA Today. I did a story where I flew down to Atlanta for a few days and I, you know, watched, you know, a taping of Inside the NBA and kind of spent some time on that set for a while. And so the first time I met Shaq, I tried to shake his hand and he brought it in for a hug instead. And you and I have met each other in person. You can kind of, I'm not a very big guy. You can kind of imagine how that went.
he would just swallow you, actually. You'd just be lost in him.
I'm surprised he was in one piece. This is 2 years later.
And yeah, you're right, by the way. Look, Shaq, as we were mentioning right there, you don't even blink, unquestioned NBA, you know, unquestioned Hall of Famer.
One of the 5 or 6 greatest centers of all time. Yeah.
And Allen Iverson, both as a great player and a guy who ushered in a new era of the NBA in terms of hip-hop, bringing that in and changing the game.
At his peak, he was so, and I mean, he's a guy that, you know, a lot of the advanced metrics don't really like because he wasn't that efficient, but he was so, like, the fact that Sixers team made the finals.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at who else was on that team. Eric Snow was a starter on a team that made the finals. If you look at the rest of the team, the other thing is, and this is just kind of a bookkeeping thing, and unfortunately, Derrick Rose might be the first one to be the exception to this rule in the future, but no player in league history has ever won MVP and not made the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, wow, that's a good point about Rose. I'd never thought about that.
He might be the first.
That would be, yeah, because right now, I mean, just thinking about it, right now, he's not. I mean, despite that great start, he's not. So we'll see how his career turns out. He'll prove us all wrong, and they'll win 5 titles in a row in Chicago again. There's some other interesting names on that list of guys who could, should, maybes. A guy I've wanted to see for a little while because the two other running mates from his line are in there. I would like to see Tim Hardaway make it.
Yeah, I tend to be pretty liberal with this stuff. I feel like if, you know, guys who are kind of borderline cases where you can make a case that they should or they shouldn't, I'm usually just like, yeah, you know, let them in. I'm like, once Sean Marion has his Hall of Fame case, I'm very pro Sean Marion being in the Hall of Fame.
Oof. I don't know. You know, he certainly was revolutionary in terms of just the positionless kind of ahead of you know, doing what the Warriors are doing now, but, you know, in with those Sixers before anybody else was doing it. But what about Amari?
Yeah, Amari's an interesting one, too, because if you just look at his peak, you know, he was a top five player in the league for a few years there.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, well, I mean, okay, is Tracy McGrady a Hall of Famer? Because he had a really short peak, too, before the injuries. But the peak was so high that you can't really very well say, no, he's not.
Yeah, that's I mean, it depends on how much you're going to credit. And that's the same thing longevity.
With, you know, another guy you have in this list of, you know, borderline guys is Chris Webber, who, you know, he was so, you know, he maybe didn't live up to his potential. He had the potential to be one of the greatest players of all time, but he was so good those few years that he had in, you know, in Sacramento, first like in Washington, and then especially in Sacramento. Those Kings teams were some of, you know, widely regarded as some of the best teams to never win a title. You know, I think I would put Webber in too, and I would also probably put Tim Hardaway in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with Webber. He was also, I think people forget how good them, you know, sometimes teams don't make it to the finals or don't get on that stage. Those Webber's Kings teams were really, really good. They just ran into the so Shaq good. Kobe Lakers, and you just, you know, it's the Stockton Malone problem of, yeah.
Right. It's just like, I mean, we were just talking about Amari, those Suns teams, obviously, you know, Steve Nash is a no doubt about it Hall of Famer. You know, we're talking about Amari, we're talking about Sean Marion. If those teams had won some titles in the mid 2000s, like in 06 or 07, we might be talking about those guys differently, but it's like, okay, they happened to run into the Spurs those years in the playoffs, and then that just kind of changes the conversation. But, you know, I think you have to view those teams as kind of the same, you know, kind of an earlier version of, you know, the 7 seconds or less Suns, those Sacramento teams, and especially, you know, including another guy, you know, he's in the international category, but Vlade Divac, you know, he was one of the defining guys on those Kings teams in the early 2000s also.
And in the Lakers and traded for Kobe.
That shifted the landscape of the NBA.
I think Vlade on the international side, because you're talking about a guy who really did help popularize, because Eastern Europe, obviously there were players before and after him a little bit, but he's kind of at the front end of that Eastern European thing. And, you know, all I really want is Vlade to get in so he walks up and then like flops at the podium or something. Just
have you seen the 30 for 30 they did like 5 years ago about him and Drazen?
Yeah, which is that a great one.
That's one of the best 30 for 30s.
Yeah, that is that actually, if you haven't seen it, that one and that is probably one of my two or three favorite.
The Iverson one was really good too.
Iverson's one really good. I think my favorite remains the Colombian cartel soccer one, which is just insane. How the Medellin cartel paid for Colombian soccer. That was a really interesting one, and a real tragedy with Drazen, but the whole, like, how that whole thing worked out over there was fascinating. Another guy on the list that I kind of think should get in as a coach is Bill Fitch, two-time coach of the year. It's a little weird because you're like, he's won 944 NBA games. Of course, he's lost like 1,100. But he's still a guy who put up a lot of wins and really coached a lot of pretty good teams over the years. Won an NBA championship with the Celtics in the 80s, the Larry Bird era. So I don't have a problem with that. He got Houston in deep. So he's got a ring. He's a couple-time coach of the year.
In 1996, when they did the, you know, the top 50 players list, they also did a top 10 coaches list, and he was on there.
Yeah, at the time. I got to just think at that point, you pretty much should be in. So hopefully that's a guy that gets in. Also on the list, who else did we... Oh, what about, you know, throwing out an interesting name, Tony Kukoc, since you're in Chicago?
Fine with it.
Yeah, I think people forget, again, because he got overshadowed by the Jordan... And by the way, Jordan. Got overshadowed by Jordan / Jordan didn't like him because he was, you know, Jerry Krause's guy. But was a really great player.
Yeah.
And was a key part of what... Now, did he have... I don't have to look it up now off the top of my head. I think he was there for all three of the second ones or just two-thirds of them. I mean, I don't remember how many rings he ended up
with. Well, because he came over the year that Jordan was playing baseball.
So, yeah. So he was there for all three of the second...
So he was there for the second three-peat.
Yeah. So he's... I mean, three titles. A guy I would think, honestly, probably gets in. I don't know that you let Jordan introduce him, but
that would be fun.
But But I'm with you. I tend to get the other part of this you have to remember is it is not the NBA Hall of Fame. And I, with John Hollinger and a lot of other guys who have long said, I would love to see a separate NBA Hall of Fame. And they're,
yeah, I'm with 100% with
that. And I'm, if we do that, I'm probably stricter. Like, does Kukoc make it in an NBA Hall of Fame? No, no, no.
Maybe not, but in terms of, like, the international stuff. And that's the other thing with Weber is you have to factor in, like, how important the Fab Five was.
Yeah, that's actually a great point.
You have to kind of take that into consideration. So I would say, you know, because of that, because it's the Basketball Hall of Fame and not just the NBA Hall of Fame, I think Weber should definitely be in.
Yeah,
and this is not his first year of eligibility. He's gotten left out before.
Yeah, and he might, you know, he's seen... At least let's put it this way. He handles it really well when they ask him on NBA TV. But I can't. I got to think he's pretty frustrated with all of that. Finally, the one guy we also know is getting in is Marv Albert.
Yeah.
And that's a, like, given, done, you know.
Marv's great.
Yeah, and, yeah. Can we get Breen next? Like, just, you know. There's plenty of guys on that list. And by the way, we're just talking about the NBA guys. There's a long list of some deserving WNBA players and college coach Lefty Giselle and some of these guys are in there who should probably be in as well, but I don't think John and I are not going to be debating the college coaching ranks anymore. Outside,
you might want to have Curtis Harris on to do like a more in-depth historical podcast of like how which of these people should get in the Hall of Fame. That's a little bit more his wheelhouse than mine.
Yeah, exactly. So we will probably do some of this as that gets closer, but since the names were out and there were some interesting ones, we thought we'd discuss a little bit. We will. Thanks, Sean, for being here and talking NBA. We will be back on Thursday. Like I said, Dan and I are going to be breaking down all the Christmas Day games. Stinkers, though, a couple of them may end up being. But
Spurs Rockets seemed like such a good idea at the time.
Yeah, you know, didn't it? Didn't Spurs Rockets seem like that one's going to go down? Although Rockets have had their moments lately, but the Spurs are. I mean, we didn't get into it in this podcast.
My favorite thing about this slate is that when they came out with the schedule, everybody was looking at it as such a victory that the Knicks weren't on it. How much would you rather have for Porzingis on Christmas than some of these other games that are on?
Honestly, wouldn't you like the first morning game, and they just played last week, but wouldn't you like the first morning game to be like New York-Minnesota?
Like, yeah, I would love that. I mean, put the rookies out there and let them go. For Minnesota being one of the Christmas games, but I would love that.
Yeah, I don't know that it would draw well enough, but the idea of just that matchup, which if anybody didn't see it, go to draftexpress.com. You can find they actually broke down the matchup, and Towns put up 25 and certainly won the statistical category, and I still think, look, rookie of the year, probably the best guy out of this draft class in a couple years. And all that said, Porzingis had 7 blocks and showed a lot of his potential in this. Like, you can see where he's going to be. You know, he's really inconsistent right now because he's a rookie, but you can see where this kid can go and be a cornerstone for the Knicks. So I'd almost,
Those are the two runaway candidates for rookie of the year. It's going to be one of those two.
Yeah, who's third? I mean, I guess Okafor. I mean, he's putting up numbers.
Yeah, but he's not on the level of Towns or Porzingis.
No, but how much of that is on? And this goes back to the Sixers we were talking about earlier. How much of that is on him? Like, if he had a point guard and some floor spacing, would it be different? I mean, there's no way to.
We'll see.
What if? It's kind of a what if conversation, but you know, that kid better learn to pass out of the doubles fast because you know he's a rookie and like the first day he's going to see them. So,
right.
Well, thanks a lot. And fans, we will talk to you on Thursday. Thanks for checking out the Pro Basketball Talk podcast.